Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Space Shuttle Columbia was a science experiment in space. In fact, it was 80 experiments in space. It was the first such flight in 3 years to place such a heavy emphasis on research. Its crew members came from around the world, from Israel, from India, from Spokane, from Racine, Wisconsin. With them on the shuttle were 8 garden orb weaver spiders. Part of an experiment to examine the strength of webs woven without gravity. The spiders were sent by students at the Glen Waverley Secondary School in Melbourne, Australia. There were ants from the Fowler High School in Syracuse, silkworms from students in Beijing, and carpenter bees from Liechtenstein. There were dozens of other more sophisticated payloads and investigations. Among them, a zeolite crystal growth furnace from the Center for Advanced Microgravity Materials Processing at Northeastern University in Boston. The man behind that work is here in the studio. Connection listeners, we're talking about space shuttle science this hour. What do we learn from space that we can't learn here on Earth? And is what we learn from missions like Columbia's important enough to justify the danger and the cost? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Kelly Beattie. Kelly's the executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, our resident expert on space. And Kelly, you were here just last week talking about being one of the many who had hope at one point to be up in space. Were you keeping track on Saturday of the return of Columbia?
Glued to the television, Dick. It was just stunning, and it takes a while for something like that to sink in.
And also in the studio, Al Sacco. Al is professor of chemical engineering at Northeastern University. He was a mission specialist on Columbia in 1995, and I guess that means you had some real attachment to what was happening over the weekend, some personal attachment.
Yeah, I very, very much did. I knew all those folks. I had trained a number of them for about 3 years in close contact. They were my friends. They were my colleagues. And they were in the astronaut office when I flew.
1995, that's 8 years ago you were on Columbia. Would it have changed dramatically in the time since then?
Well, it depends on what you mean by change. The vehicle was the most sturdy vehicle we had. It was built as the first one to go into space. We weren't sure of all the stresses it would take, so it was really over-designed. But after each shuttle mission, they take out all the engines, they take out all the computers, they replace everything, they check them out and put them back in. So while the carriage itself, the body itself, was Columbia from 1981, everything inside it was changed out on a regular basis.
So tell me about your connection. If you were a payload specialist in 95, does that put you in the program, in a sense, for helping other payload specialists, mission specialists in years after that?
Well, it depends. Different things. I maintain my flight physical, and if the opportunity comes, I'd like to fly again. But it also, I happen to be a principal investigator, which means I go through the normal NASA science peer review. Because I have a lot of experience in space, I bring an added training component to it, which most principal investigators don't. Because doing experiments in space is not exactly like doing them in the ground. There's differences.
Can we get at that a little bit? Because that's in many ways how I want to try and cast the hour. Kelly, you've talked to us in the past about the importance of having that work done out of the Earth's atmosphere. If you were to put your finger on the principal reason why it matters, what would you say?
I got two fingers. One is that you take advantage of the lack of gravity. You're never completely free of gravity because the shuttle jostles around a little bit in orbit, but you try to have as close to zero gravity as completely possible. And the second reason is that there are just some experiments that need a lot of hand-holding. They need people to make sure they work properly. So, and a lot of those experiments have to do with the people themselves, finding out how the human body orients itself in space and maintains itself are sort of the key biomedical research areas that are undertaken.
So, Al, the latest investigation that you sent up, the zeolite crystal growth furnace from your center at Northeastern, it needed someone in space to be doing some work, or is it one of those ones which could, in fact, have gone on an unmanned mission.
No, we in fact needed someone, and we took advantage of that, what people call zero gravity, the free fall environment of low Earth orbit that makes it a sense because of the speed, like your low gravity. And what that does for a science group is it eliminates convective flows, the movement of materials. In our case, we see it when you're on the highway and you see what looks like air drifting upwards, you see a distortion. That happens on the ground, but in low Earth orbit, you don't see that at all because of the free fall environment. What we really needed the crew for, though, is not that. We could have automated that portion of the crystal growth. What we needed them to do is, it turns out when you mix fluids in orbit, they don't mix like they do on the ground because surface tension becomes a dominant force that you don't really have here. You can simulate it, and I was in my flight, we did a lot of fluid physics that we tried to simulate it, and about 60% of the simulations were accurate from the best people we have in the world, and about 40% weren't. So you need, if you're really going to do some serious work, you need people up there actually looking at it, knowing what to look at, how things should mix. In crystal growth, that's critical. If we don't miss the components correctly, we don't get the final product that we want to get.
But learning how different elements behave in a situation which does not exist on Earth, how can what is learned up there be applied to what matters down here on Earth?
Well, we look at space for looking at leapfrog technologies. And what I mean by that is, one of the things we were looking at is a specific crystal that was brought to us by an industrial company where they couldn't grow it with enough openness. They had a lot of what crystal growers call faults in it, defects. In space, it's a very well-known and documented fact that when you grow materials in space, because of this lack of this movement of fluids, which is like growing a material in a washing machine, which is what happens on the ground, basically you get a very quiescent fluid. And because of that, things will align themselves more naturally, and you get a very, very uniform structure. They were looking at that in order to have a very uniform open structure for hydrogen storage. And you heard about that for the first time with the president's speech when he talked about hydrogen fuel cells. One of the big problems with fuel cells, if they're going to go commercial, is the ambient storage of hydrogen. And one of the materials we were looking at was like a molecular sponge for that. Now, those can't be grown on the ground very well. And so the idea is, let's see if we can grow them in orbit. And if we can, let's learn how to grow them in the ground from what we find in orbit.
And Kelly, who is NASA looking for when they're putting together a team of mission specialists and payload specialists? Because in many cases, although Al was there and had a chance to work on his own stuff, they have many other responsibilities while they're in orbit, right?
The astronaut crew to which David Brown belonged, a large contingent of shuttle candidates, came in 1996 into the NASA program in the astronaut corps. And if you took a cross-section of those people, You would find that they are uniformly overachievers, not just engineers, but engineers who have doctorates, or they're physicians, or physicians who are fighter pilots, or fighter pilots who are astronomers on the side. So their cross-disciplinary expertise makes them invaluable in orbit because you can throw 80 experiments at them, and they have a sense of what each one is supposed to do, and they're very quick studies. So we're not talking about the sort of Mercury-era fighter jocks who had one job and one job alone. These people are really multi-talented and can adapt to any situation.
Which speaks, I guess, to why it is we admire them so much, because they're not just a scientist, as you say. They're not just a Navy pilot. They have all these other skills.
That's true, and they have one other quality that I think we often lose sight of until a tragedy like this happens, and in that they're pretty much ordinary, everyday people. They go to church, they have kids, they're soccer moms and soccer dads. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that in the routine or near routine of space flight, we've kind of lost sight of that. I'd say that before Saturday, anyone would be hard-pressed to name a current astronaut off the top of their head, and yet there are more than nearly 150 in the NASA Corps alone.
Al, when you think back to the time that you were on the Columbia in 95, you have so much to do, so much scientific work that you want to get accomplished in a really, really short period of time. Do you have the opportunity at a moment like that to consider where you are, the company that you're with, the kind of standing of the crew that you're that you're working with that Kelly's just describing.
Yeah, I think you do. But you have to realize, for a scientist like me, I was like a kid in a candy store. I was up there. We had 120 different science experiments. The crystal growth part, of which we did protein crystal growth, electronic materials, zeolite crystal growth, that I was very familiar with and very good at, and that's why I was put on that shuttle mission. But I also did a lot of fluid physics and combustion experiments in biology. So to me, and to an academician, it's a dream come true. It was great. I could. They had to stop me from working. We had a 12-hour day, and they had to pull me off of it. Because I was having a great time. On the 12 hours off, it takes a lot of time to do normal hygiene in orbit, which you don't think about, but it really does. But I spent most of my time looking out of the windows on the 12 hours that I had off. You don't need to sleep very much in orbit. You sleep about two-thirds of what you sleep on the ground. So if you usually sleep 6 hours, you typically sleep 4 for the same amount of rest. So you get a lot of chance to look and ponder what you're doing. I pondered not only looking at the Earth, which is absolutely fantastic, and Laurel Clark sent me an email about 3 days before they landing, thanking me for the experiment she was doing, but also saying, this is the most beautiful experience of my life. I've never seen anything like it. And believe me when I tell you, the Earth is absolutely unbelievably beautiful. It's a very humbling experience to be in space and to realize how small Earth is in the overall scheme of things, and therefore how small we are. And it's a really mind-opening experience. So, yes, we did have time to ponder. We always did. Sometimes we'd pinch ourselves and say, how could we be this lucky to be up here?
What's also mind-opening, just to hear you describe, getting an email from someone in space. These were, as you said earlier in the program, friends of yours, but they were just communicating with you from out there. Kalpana Chawla was also a friend of yours.
Exactly. Casey. Yeah, they were friends of mine. And not only that, the Increment 6 commander, who's in charge of the International Space Station now, Ken Bowersox, was my first commander for my shuttle flight. And he actually called me on a cell phone, which I didn't realize that they had cell phones. He called me when he first said, it's Sox, which is what we called him. I said, get out of here. And he did. We had a 40-minute conversation about what he was doing up there and how much fun he was having and what was going right and what was going wrong. And it's just amazing. I also get, from my experiment, I don't know if you know this, but we have the opportunity to get text messages. So I get text messages down that would give me the health and status of where my experiment was, what the temperatures were, what the power levels were, and also give me a warning light. So if the crew didn't see it, I could see it.
And I've been reading about some scientists who got the information they were looking for, others who won't get that information. Do you know now what you wanted to know from that experiment?
No, we really lost most of the stuff because we were really looking at the crystals. I mean, we have telemetry that tell us the temperatures, the vibration levels, the acceleration levels, all those kind of things, which are of interest in analyzing the crystals. But the crystals themselves, we won't get back. But you know, compared to my friends, it's such a small loss that that doesn't bother me very much. It's just, I lost a member of my family. NASA's a big family, and the astronaut office is particularly tight because of the work that we're doing.
Connection listeners, we're talking about science in space this hour. One of the things that marked the Columbia was that it was the first shuttle in 3 years to have so much science packed inside the shuttle. And it cost a lot of money to get that stuff up there. It's a very dangerous business, which we know now. And we're interested in hearing from you about the value, the importance of continuing that work. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about science in space. With me in the studio, Al Sacco, professor of chemical engineering at Northeastern University, himself a mission specialist on the Columbia in 1995. He trained 4 members of the crew that were lost this weekend. Kelly Beattie's also with us. He's executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, did an in-depth profile of one of the astronauts, Dave Brown, for Parade magazine, and knows the people and the work that was involved quite well. Joining us on the line now from Tel Aviv is Professor Zev Levin. He teaches at the Department of Geophysics there and is the principal investigator of the Israeli experiment aboard the Columbia Space Shuttle. Professor, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you very much.
I'm interested in hearing from you a sense of how Israel watched what was happening. I ask you the question because in mid-January, we were doing an interview with one of your politicians, or we were supposed to be doing an interview with one of your politicians, and he wouldn't come to the telephone. He was determined to watch the Columbia take off. It was a big deal in Israel.
Well, it is a big deal even today. We all mourn what happened last Saturday. To us, it was sort of in the special, especially during these difficult days in Israel, this was a morale booster for everybody here. And in addition, we all had great hopes for the scientific outcome of these experiments. I must say, in spite of the terrible loss, some of the data is available for further analysis. But in terms of the country, I would say that the news media is full of mourning and stories about the family, about Ilan himself, the Israeli astronaut. We were devastated.
Just briefly, what was it that you were hoping to learn with the scientific experiment that you were involved with?
Our experiment had a number of components to it. One component, which actually the name of the experiment was called after, it's called MADEX, Mediterranean Israeli Dust Experiment. The objective was to study the properties, the chemical and physical and optical properties of dust storms as they are transported over the Mediterranean region. However, as the shuttle launch date has been pushed and delays were coming one after the other, we decided to enlarge the area of interest and included some of the Atlantic region as well, so we could actually photograph or take images of dust storms coming out of Africa towards America. And at the same time, when the shuttle is flying overhead, there is a small research aircraft flying through the dust storm trying to collect some dust particles, study their size, their chemical composition, and try to compare the results of the in-situ measurements with those measurements that are remotely taken from space. So this was one of the main objectives of the experiment.
And if someone were, or if I were to ask you, looking at all the money and the preparation that went into that, looking at the danger that we now know of, is it important to continue to do that sort of work and do it in space? What would you say?
I would say in many of the elements of the experiments could be done with unmanned satellites. However, there was another component to our experiment which could not be done from, at least not at the moment, could not be done from a satellite. For example, we were studying also sprites. Those are very small, sharp, light-emitting regions above thunderstorms that were discovered for the first time about 15 years ago. And we don't really understand the processes that make or that produce these particular lights. And one had to aim the cameras above thunderstorms. It required a specific orientation of the shuttle itself, of the orbiter itself, in order to see it. And the astronaut with their naked eye could not even see, even though they photographed it. They only had to send it down to the ground for analysis when we discovered those sprites again. So you needed somebody up there to aim the camera in the right direction to see where the thunderstorms are and aim the camera properly. So definitely an astronaut or a human interference here was important.
Professor, thanks for being with us.
I'll appreciate it.
Professor Zev Levin teaches at the Department of Geophysics and Planetary Sciences in Tel Aviv University. Kelly Beatty, I did have in front of me, two pages of the types of experiments that were on board Columbia, broken down into physical sciences, earth and space sciences, biology, and the print is very small. There's quite a range of stuff going on up there.
Practically every major scientific discipline is reflected in that in one way or another, except maybe astronomy, which is too bad for me. You know, a lot of what goes on in these experiments has to do with the biomedical side of things, how body and tissue react in orbit. So just to take a couple of snapshots from that long list of 80 experiments, there were studies on how the body maintains its immune system, how calcium, which tends to be in the bones, how the bones deteriorate while in space. That's a major concern for long-term spaceflight that the both the astronauts and the Russian space program has concentrated on for a long time. How the vestibular system, you know, your ears, your inner ear, relies on gravity to know where it is, and in the absence of that, that's important. And you go from that all the way over to other things like Al's zeolite experiment. There was another sort of combustion experiment where they had to dilute flammable gas, and they would set off sparks in this chamber, and the sparks would, like a voracious little Pac-Man animal, would go around in the chamber as a little glowing ball of fire that would go to where the fuel was, and they followed that. And then there were a number of experiments, like Dr. Levin's, that you know, were looking outside the shuttle, looking at the Earth, looking for ozone, measuring the amount of solar radiation, and the list goes on and on. You can see it was like a wide palette of experiments.
Was NASA, in any way to either one of you, was NASA drifting away from its concentration on science? I mean, we talk about this as the first really, you know, intense scientific shuttle in a long time. What was the rest of the work then?
Well, I think from my perspective as a PI, basically they were doing a lot of ground-based work. But there was
What does that mean, Al? Ground-based
that means that we were doing basic science on the ground to develop the database for comparison of what's going to happen in orbit based on what the predictions were. And that always takes 2 or 3 years. So people don't know. Very often it takes 2 to 3 to 5 years before you fly just to get that database that you need. But so that was going along. But there was no question. The emphasis was getting the International Space Station up. And the reason for that was primarily because people recognize that 16-day missions like the one I did, the one the Columbia did, were not long enough to make a mistake in orbit, scientific mistake, and say, geez, that didn't work, let's try something else, which is what happens on the ground. The International Space Station is going to give scientists that opportunity. But the science community had bottled up so much, so many experiments that needed to be done, that they demanded that STS-107 be put into orbit. And prior to this accident, they demanded an additional one as well, because they were falling too far behind. They were ready to go. The International Space Station wasn't in a configuration to house all of them yet in terms of power requirements. And some of them didn't require, or they were willing to take the hit on, we won't do multiple experiments, we'll just do one.
Right.
So I think it's really a credit to the space program. But 107 was demanded by the science community.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go first to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brad's joining us. Hi, Brad. Brad, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Go ahead.
I wanted to make a comment and raise a question about an often overlooked aspect of this mission, which is the fact that most of the experiments that were carried on this Columbia flight were accommodated in a commercially provided laboratory environment built by a company called SpaceHab.
I saw a photograph of that on the website.
Right. That environment, those laboratory modules that the company developed over approximately a 15-year period, and which have flown on numerous previous space shuttle missions, represented the first time that the private sector had invested that kind of capital to develop a capability that would permit astronauts to live and work in a much expanded workspace on the space shuttle, as opposed to being relegated to the flight deck or the crew compartment, which, as you know, is a very small volume and not really adequate to perform the sorts of experiments and the number of experiments that were conducted here. The question really is, given this setback and given the role that the private sector has played episodically over the last 15 years, but certainly SpaceHub, I think, is a good example of a significant investment that's helped the space program in this regard. Given this setback, what will be the implications for continued private sector investment in the space program for scientific or other reasons?
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, do you think that people will look at this weekend's disaster as reason enough to stay away?
Well, you know, people have always needed to be convinced, I think, and for some of your guests who are quite familiar with the last 20 years or so of NASA's efforts to encourage private sector interest in the space program, they recognize that it's been one step forward, two steps back on occasion. There have been great successes, but there have also been, you know, significant disappointments. I think one of the concerns that people have had in the industrial scientific community is that the number of space shuttle missions had been reduced for budgetary and other reasons to the point where it was very unusual to be able to provide a space shuttle environment for private sector or any sort of industrial or scientific research to occur on a concentrated basis. The space shuttle fleet had really become more of a moving and storage company to help the space station become operational and to keep the astronauts who are on the space station presently outfitted and accommodated and to bring them back to Earth and so forth.
All right, Brad, let me turn to Kelly Beattie on this. Kelly.
Yeah, Brad, you bring up a good point about SpaceHab. I can tell you that I've learned that SpaceHab was fully insured, so the company won't go bankrupt or anything like that. SpaceHab is the latest in a series of onboard modules. Prior to SpaceHab, which is commercial, you're right, it's the first commercial, there was a Space Lab, which was built by the European Space Agency. That was its contribution to the shuttle program. It's a large pressurized can the size of a small bus that fits inside the shuttle payload bay. And as you say, it expands the laboratory environment for the scientists and astronauts to work in. I actually don't see any long-term effect on this in private investment. I really don't think that they will miss a beat. What is the greater concern is, will there be more opportunities, as you suggest, for the shuttle to fly and carry experiments? Because it's true that when the space station was announced, a shudder went through the scientific community because they knew that most, if not all, of the space shuttle flights were going to be committed to doing this ferry work to and from the mm-hmm. station. The light at the end of the tunnel was supposed to be the science that could be accommodated aboard the space station, and unfortunately, due to budget cuts, that's being gradually pared back.
Al, I understand that on this particular shuttle, about 80% of the science experiments were NASA-sponsored, about 20% were private, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not sure of those figures, but I would guess that's very typical. And let me weigh in on this a little bit, because the Center for Advanced Microgravity Material Processing here at Northeastern is a NASA commercial space center. The full attempt there is to bring U.S. industry in and take advantage of the International Space Station and shuttle activities. The caller is exactly right. The problem in demand for space experimentation has been frequency of flights. NASA, though, has put together this commercial space center idea with the attempt to get about one-third access to the International Space Station and one-third access to shuttle flights. So what you see with that 20-25% is basically one-third commercial that NASA says, okay, there's a huge amount of basic science that we have in the pipeline, but we're going to cut out about a third, 25 to a third, it varies between 20% and 40%, that we're going to allow every space flight, whether it's to station or it's on STS-107, the Columbia, the one that we just had the tragedy with, that will be commercial-oriented. The intention is eventually to find out what we can really do commercially so it's better here on Earth for people here on the ground with that environment.
1-800-423-8255. Brad, thanks for that. Next to Janesville, Wisconsin, and Dennis is joining us. Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for allowing me on the air today. Not to make this sound as a knee-jerk reaction to this occurrence, but, for a long time I've thought we really need to, Saddam Hussein can't account for something. I'm trying to remember the last time the GOA tried to go through the paperwork for any operation of our government and have accountability for cash. The money and resources in this, I would like to see us keep our feet firmly on the ground for about 10 years before we know more. We can't bring a shuttle back in without blowing it up, and we're playing with the universe out there.
In your mind, Dennis, is it a question of cost? Are you saying that the money in the shuttle program is wasted money, or that the technology is not there in your view?
It's a matter of priorities and really us being able to deal with each other as human beings first before we go and become Columbus going across the water and naming the Indians because we think we landed in India.
Okay, Dennis, let me start with Al Sacco on that. Al.
Yeah, obviously, I have a much different opinion of that, and I put myself and my family at risk based on that dream, that opinion I have. I think we'll go for a better world. I think just the opposite, actually. Where would we be if Columbus and his group had not gone out and all the great explorers? Yeah, it's the human spirit. You're not going to stop it anyways. It is going to go forward. Something like this makes people come out and say, well, is it really worth the effort? Shouldn't we look at what the problems we have at home? But, you know, the truth of the matter, it's technology drivers that make the problem go away. Now, well, those technology drivers can be in a war, which is a big technology driver, or they can be national efforts in different areas, whether that has to be exploring the ocean or exploring space. But with all of those will come risk.
Kelly?
I have often been asked about the value of space travel. And, you know, this is one of the last frontiers available to us to explore, for pure exploration. And it still has the power to excite us and to invigorate us as a society and as a civilization. That said, it's undeniably true that space travel is expensive. The shuttle program consumes about $3 billion a year in round numbers. You get about a half dozen flights. That's $500 million per flight. What could you do with that money otherwise? You could certainly do things on Earth to alleviate, for example, take that money and spend it on AIDS research or alleviating AIDS in Africa. But if you compare that money on the larger scale to, say, the amount spent by Health and Human Services or on education, it's really a drop in the bucket. So you could eradicate the space program. You know, NASA's budget is roughly $15 billion a year, and spread it out over all the other things that the government does, and really you would barely see a blip.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add that I've talked to about, maybe close to 10,000 elementary school children. And what price of mind? What price is that to excite our future generations into going into not necessarily space, but just science and technology, realizing the wonders of the universe, to go into medicine, to go into solve all those diseases? Because remember, you need to stimulate these children. That's the most important thing. And if NASA did nothing else but that, it would be well worth the investment, in my opinion.
Connection listeners, your opinion, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about the science aboard shuttles like the Shuttle Columbia, which came down over the weekend, causing the death of some seven astronauts. It's interesting to look at elsewhere in the newspaper. It's also a weekend when seven teenagers were killed in an avalanche in British Columbia, when 30 people were killed in a hotel fire in Asia. And yet, Kelly Beattie, the attention, and not because, I really don't believe, because these people were principally American, the attention is just so focused on Columbia. There is something about what they did, what they do, that just captures the imagination, almost aside from the money.
Part of it is that the accident was so visible. You saw those streaks across the sky and you knew that those astronauts were dying or were dead. Much like Challenger in 1986, there was an immediacy. And it's going to go down as one of those moments that we remember exactly where we were when we heard the news. The first moonwalk, Kennedy's assassination, and so forth. The other part of it is that, as we've been talking about, those astronauts carry a little bit of us with them. You know, we wish we were there, and it causes us to consider, would we take the risk ourselves? Some of us would, and some of us wouldn't.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cambridge, and Adam's on the phone. Hi, Adam.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I want to come down on the side of, we have to go back to space. We can't let this stop us, precisely for the reason you just said, which is that look at the attention that's being drawn to it. I mean, if someday the day comes where there's a shuttle crash and nobody really blinks and it doesn't even make the daily police blotter, then maybe we can talk about space isn't worth it. But as long as it is this beacon that people look to, how can we not go back? I mean, I just want to share very quickly with you a little anecdote, and then I'll just listen to what you guys have to say, is that I was reading a piece by a reporter who was traveling in sub-Saharan Africa, where a very corrupt government had spent millions on a giant Gothic cathedral built in the middle of a plain where no one has clean water, and said, you know, what a tragic waste, to one of the natives. And they said, hey, you know, don't we deserve cathedrals too? And I think that's space travel for us. I mean, that's our society's Gothic cathedral, and we deserve that too. We shouldn't be just spending money on brass tacks, but, you know, there's got to be something to dream for as well.
Okay, Adam. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. I think that that's exactly true. I mean, if you look at, for an example, if you look at the entertainment area, where are the movies that are big? They're the Star Wars movies. They're the vision of the human spirit moving beyond itself. Star Trek being so successful. Why? We took on human problems. We went beyond the wagon train to the stars. And the space program is, in fact, our wagon train to the stars. It's something to us to look forward to. It's the one area that we need to explore. Now, the ocean, I would claim to you, is as well, but we need to go out and move beyond. And the potential, who knows what it is? Columbus certainly didn't know what he was starting when he came across the ocean. I mean, he lost a couple of ships. He went to the wrong location. You know, all his jewelry ended up with potatoes and corn. But look at what he started. And it's the same with us, I think. And that's the dream, the human spirit. And that will not stop. We'll go forward. And if not us, someone else.
Do you think that within the NASA family that you described, there is an acknowledgement, a recognition that shuttles will disintegrate like the one like the event that happened on Saturday before space exploration is got right? You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And, you know, we're all scientists. And believe me when I tell you, when you go through what we call a training flow for flight, that point is brought home again and again and again. And we look at it from probabilities. We knew there'd be more accidents. There will be more deaths as we go forward, just like there was when the wagon train went from the East Coast to the West Coast. There will be tragedies. There will be more suffering. But in the end, it's the great belief, and it's my belief, and others like me, and the astronaut office, and the people that support us, which are the 100,000 people around the globe that support us in these efforts, that it's well worth the risk. And we will go forward and we'll make that new tomorrow.
You know, Kelly, it's probably worth just noting how international they've become. What began as an exercise or an expression of national pride with the Americans competing against the Russians now has become quite an international business is probably the wrong word with it, quite a how would you describe it? You know,
it is international. It's actually, at least from the Soviet side, has been international for a long time. In the early days of the Soviet space station sequence, beginning with Salyut and ending with Mir, they had a habit of taking into orbit a token astronaut from each of the Eastern Bloc countries. So you had a Hungarian and a mm-hmm. Romanian and so forth. To some extent, that continues today in a quasi-political sense. Some of the astronauts in the Corps are there because Canada, for example, contributes to the space program. And so NASA has a kind of open-door policy for Canadian astronauts. The European Space Agency, which I mentioned, the Space Lab, was allowed to have its astronauts in the queue as well. Still, it is something, and I think this crew demonstrates it, a very pan-American and multinational character that makes everyone feel included, no matter where you are on the Earth. You can imagine that someday you might go into space.
1-800-423-8255 to Greensboro, North Carolina, and Brian's on the phone. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
My question is twofold. First, I'd like some examples of everyday improvements in my life, you know, as a, say, an average American, that space shuttle has brought to me, the technology you always hear about, you know, what's it done in my daily life? My second question is, it's a concern that NASA is being used sort of as a political fundraising tool and a political propaganda tool by, say, something like the first Israeli astronaut. I mean, where's the practical application there, and, you know, why should our tax dollars be used for that?
I can tell you, watching the first Canadian astronaut going into space as a Canadian in Canada, that experience in part answers your question, because the way that a nation like Israel would have watched Colonel Ramon on this one, the way the Canadians watched Marc Garneau when he was the first astronaut to go up, it becomes a remarkable experience for those countries which could never hope to have a NASA program. So, Brian, that's part of the answer to your second one. But the first part of your question is one that I think both Kelly and Al can help us with in terms of, you know, explaining what goes on up there that actually makes life better down here.
Yeah, that's always a tough question because science builds on different things. But let me give you some specific applications. A lot of the medical monitoring systems that you presently use in hospitals were developed right at the Mercury and Gemini days because they wanted to monitor what was happening to the crew health. And they wanted to monitor it remotely. Now, prior to the space agency, those materials were not available, weren't even thought about. And, of course, as soon as physicians started to see that, geez, we could monitor these people 24 hours a day, blood pressure, temperature, health. So that's one of the direct benefits that you get if you go into a hospital. Another one is as simple as the infrared tool that they presently put in your ear instead of the old fashioned mercury ways to measure temperature, thermometers. They now just look in your ear. That was developed to look for deep space infrared signatures. So that came directly out of the space program. Velcro, of course, is a famous one that came out of the space program. Without Velcro, there'd be no space program. We stick everything everywhere, otherwise it floats away. But there's a whole variety of different things that you can point to directly.
Kelly, is there a favorite of yours that you point to?
Well, I think in general terms, the whole trend toward miniaturization and nanotechnology, and although I can't point to any one thing, like the transistor was not invented by the space program, it certainly was a stimulus to the technology industry in general to make things smaller, more compact. And what they found along the way, that it wasn't just that now a computer doesn't take up a whole room, but by making things smaller, things work faster, can work faster, and therefore you can process more information.
One of NASA's own experiments on this flight, Al, was a new system for recycling water in space, and I'm sure that that's the sort of thing which also could have application on Earth as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm actually a member of the Advanced Life Support Systems for NASA, and it actually goes beyond station. It's for the Mars mission and beyond, if we ever go that far. And what we're looking at is closed-loop regenerative life support systems, and we've developed them for station. Some of those is how to reclaim water. Now, where are those being used? Well, presently, they're being tested for space, but there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there that are collaborating with the government, with NASA, to see if they can use those things to get brackish water in different areas of the Amazon cleaned up, all those kind of reverse osmosis stuff that was developed for a very tight environmental set of conditions, and say, okay, can we spin this off? Can we use this as a practical application here on the ground?
I've seen very little written so far, Kelly, about what's happening with the development of the next generation of shuttle. Is that something that people will begin to focus on after Saturday's disaster?
I think so. I think that's going to be one of the take-home messages from this. The shuttles were designed to carry out roughly 100 missions. Columbia was on its 28th. NASA has put its money behind the shuttles well into this century, I think. 2015 or 2020 is the expected lifetime of the shuttles. But clearly, its time will come to an end, and we should be thinking about a different kind of mission. There are all kinds of ideas, but basically, space travel is going to remain a fairly expensive, fairly complex business. The notion that we could very easily get into space is still a long way off, I'm afraid.
And Al, tell us how this works. I mean, you saw the reaction of both NASA and the government after the Challenger explosion 17 years ago and how that affected the space program at that time. We know about the delays. We know there's nothing going up next month, for example. But does this kind of horrific event also have a silver lining?
Well, I hate to use the word silver lining, but in fact it does. And what it does is it makes us relook at procedures, relook at the vehicle, redesign things. The thing that you have to realize about the space program that no one really thinks about when you talk about designing a new vehicle, it sounds very easy to do, and in fact it's very doable. But in the space business, reliability means a lot. And reliability is not only how smart you are in putting together, but how much experience you have with the vehicle. And to give you an example of that, the launch rockets the Russians have developed in 1961 is the very same one they use today. And it's very, very reliable. They punch them out like cookies on a cookie cutter board.
It's the one they launched yesterday to go up to the space station to resupply it.
Exactly. And I've seen them launch that vehicle in a snowstorm and all sorts of stuff. And what their philosophy has been is, hey, when it works, you know everything about it, make small changes, but keep with the system, the reliability of the system. And where there's lives involved, that's extremely important. So when we talk about looking at a new launch system, that's what NASA looks at all the time. They say, yeah, we know the problems with the shuttle. We've had some horrific accidents, as have the Russians. But each time it gets a little bit safer, we get a little bit better at doing it, and we now have to make a leap that whatever we develop is not only technologically better, but in fact we feel confident enough that it's going to have a higher reliability than what we have now.
And so you say it's important that we continue. And do you say that as a member of NASA family because that's the important kind of stick to hold on to at this point, or deep down, as a scientist and a professor, do you also think that there's really just no way off this track?
No. As a scientist and professor, I think there's no way off this track. I think this is what we're going to do. This is where we're going to be going. We're going to hit bumps in the road. We're going to hit more bumps in the road as we go along. There's going to be more problems. But we are going to move forward like the humans have always done, and we will have debates, and those are good. We should debate, we should argue, we should have opinions that say we shouldn't fly in space, mm-hmm. all those things, because it makes us look inside. It makes us reevaluate what we're doing and look at it a little closer.
I want people to have a perspective on this. We've now lost two shuttles in 118 launches, 120 launches. That's roughly a 1 in 100 chance that one is going to be destroyed. You have a 1 in 100 chance of dying in a car accident, and that doesn't keep you from getting in your car every morning and driving around and maybe using that cell phone. And so I think that's the perspective we need to keep.
Kelly, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Kelly Beattie, executive editor of Sky and Telescope. Al Sacco, nice to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Al is professor of chemical engineering at Northeastern University, former mission specialist in 1995 on the Columbia. And earlier in the program, we talked with Professor Zev Levin, principal investigator of the Israeli experiment aboard the Columbia space shuttle. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is